You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 53. This minute opens with David approaching Holloway in the mess hall with an offering of libations, and ends with Holloway saying, "We made you 'cause we could." In this minute, I am joined by Clara, aka Mother. We first met through an Alien Prequels Facebook group, and since then, she's gone on to create quite an impressive alien community. There is the Yutani blog, which some of you may be listening to this very podcast on. Mother also writes in-depth articles analysing the alien films largely in the context of history, mythology, and culture. Hello, Mother.
Hello, Connor. How are you?
I am well. We've had a bit of a hiatus. What has it been? Like a month? Sorry, everyone. But I'm good. I'm ready to go.
I think it's been about a month for me too, roughly, because it depends on which mediums people listen to me on since I'm now on Twitch, YouTube, and so forth. It's hard to keep up on all the different social medias.
Yeah, you're pretty well connected through, I guess, the fandom and social media and all of that. And that's kind of why I have you on today, because as some listeners may already know, I am fascinated by the cultural impact and the controversies surrounding the Alien prequels and also the kind of fandom that has arisen from it. So I think of everyone I know, you could probably speak most to the fandom and the experience of being a part of that.
Oh, yes. in some ways, I guess. Yeah, I'm just everywhere. I try to be anyway.
Yeah, I am seriously impressed by just the amount of projects that you've got coming out. And, well, if people want to see what Mother gets up to, it's yutani.studio, I think.
Yes, that's correct. Yutani.studio is the address now.
I'm doing all the promo stuff up top because I notice a lot of people do it at the end of an episode when people stop listening. So now I'm just not giving people the choice.
That's very good. Don't let them escape.
Yes. So as for all the fandom discussion and stuff, we'll leave that for a later episode. But for now, did you want to give us a bit of background as to how you got into Alien and your initial reactions specifically to Prometheus, but Covenant as well?
Okay. Well, I was quite young when I was introduced to the Alien series. My cousin was babysitting me and she wanted to go watch Jim Cameron's Aliens in the cinema. So she put on Alien at home, and that whole time, well, I think it was at home, maybe it was at the drive-in, I can't remember. I was only about 3 and a half, four years old, right. But I remember sitting on this leathery couch. I think it must have been inside the car. So it was a drive-in cinema, and I watched Alien for the first time when I was 4 years old, and I was just absolutely mesmerized, just everything that was happening. I felt a very deep connection to the alien and to Ash, more so than the crew. And that's when I knew there was something wrong with me.
it just seems, it's very you.
Yes.
It sums up a lot, yeah.
Yeah, I started crying when the alien got flushed out of the airlock because I was worried about it.
It's just a baby. It did nothing wrong.
That's right. It didn't even have a chance to live. So that's where I found myself. Soon after that, I got to watch Aliens as well, I believe also in the drive-in cinema, and that was pretty amazing.
Around the same age?
It might have been a year later, so about 5. You know, back then when they used to run movies for a lot longer than 6 weeks?
Yeah, part of me was thinking, oh, is that because I was a kid, so everything seems to last way longer? But no, I was looking at, it was a Phantom Menace, I think. And that was in cinemas for about, from memory, like 2 or 3 months, which is forever compared to what they do these days. Like, I wanted to go see Bumblebee, and next thing I know, there's only like 2 sessions left. Give me a chance.
And always the morning sessions that you can't get to. I really find that annoying.
Now I'm thinking, because you're introduced to Alien so young, it's sort of before, well, I don't know, I mean, little kids can obviously experience fear, but when it comes to movies, I'm wondering if you're almost too young to really understand horror the same way an adult would.
Oh no, I don't think so. My first experience of horror was actually The Exorcist. I was 3 at the time, And it scared me so much that I stayed awake for 3 days and they had to take me to hospital to sedate me.
Oh, shit.
Because I was so frightened.
Whoa.
But that was my initiation. And because of that, when I watched Alien, it didn't scare me.
Oh, right. So you've just been inoculated. So.
Yeah, I guess so. I've never found anything really scary. It takes a lot to scare me these days. So I have a very deep appreciation for the sorts of fears people have and the monsters that kind of come out of our minds and get created and put onto the screen. That's my obsession.
So which movie was it that really started the whole obsession?
To be honest, I always thought of myself as a pretty big fan. And that was just because, you know, I'd watched every movie, knew all the characters and stuff like that. But what really pulled me back into the universe was a combination between Prometheus and Covenant.
I would say I'm about the same, yeah.
Yeah, it's strange because, like, when you watch Alien when you're younger and you don't really kind of understand the sort of themes that are being presented, you can only kind of like it at that sort of face value where it's action, or you see that, like, there's certain sort of cinema tropes. But when you grow up and you become more experienced with the world, and there's this kind of nuanced viewing when you're looking through it through a lens of knowledge, where you become so much more invested in it because you are more familiarized with the art that it references, the literature that it references, and then you kind of pull all those things together. It's kind of like a puzzle, and when you interlock it all together and you look at it through that, it becomes so much more deeper and so much more important that you can just nearly talk about it nonstop, which we both do in Alien groups.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really good way to describe it, that as when you are a kid and you don't know as much about film language and how to analyze media, you are just engaging with it on a very surface level. And then nowadays, the two of us have found so many parallels to other bits of culture, or just understanding, oh, this is probably what the filmmakers were trying to convey, and these are the deeper themes and all that, which, yeah. Even when I first watched Prometheus when I was 20, which, you know, seems fairly mature, but no, I was not a mature 20-year-old, and so I just went, oh yeah, Prometheus was real cool, and I like David, and that was pretty much the extent of it. And then Alien Covenant came out, and it awoke something in me. I just went, oh my God, this is so cool. I want to dedicate at least a year of my life to talking about this.
And we did. I think there was a mistake when you mentioned that we'd met on Facebook, because in actual fact, I think we started chatting on Tumblr because we both had blogs. And
that's right. And we were
private messaging each other and talking about, you know, David's characteristics and why does he do the things he does. And we're discussing about why Walter is so important.
Walter's the goddamn best.
Being compared to David. Yeah.
Yeah, wait for Alien Covenant minute. I am going to be talking maybe a bit too much about Walter and not the rest of the film.
Put me down for as many minutes as I'm allowed to hog for that.
Sorted.
Yes. Alien Covenant might have been the catalyst to me.
But initially you didn't like Covenant, I think I recall you.
Yeah. Oh, man, I walked out of that cinema so angry. I was angry at Ridley Scott. I was angry at Fox. I was angry at Michael Fassbender for portraying two robots and then kissing himself. I was so angry about the flute. There were so many things that
I'm giving you the flute scene. There
I just didn't understand. But for me, it was understanding. I'm not saying other people don't, and if they don't connect with it, that's fine. But for me, it was that lack of understanding. And when I don't understand something, I research it, I obsess about it. And when I started researching Alien Covenant and all of the symbolism and all of these things, it opened my eyes and it made it so much more deeper than I had initially perceived it, that I was then angry at myself for not giving it time to kind of stew in my brain and reacting the way that I did. So then I ended up becoming an advocate for changing people's mind. About the film.
That's interesting. So it was like on that critical and an analytical level, at least on the surface, the first time you watched it, you went, oh, well, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't work. And then you could say your initial reaction was the visceral, emotional one, but it was coming from an analytical perspective. But then still using that analytical thinking to bring yourself around to liking it. I think that's really great, because I think a lot of people, you know, they go, I don't like this, and then that's it. They sort of double down after that.
I'm not the type of person that likes to stick with one point of view, especially when I feel like facts are being presented to me and I have to be, I don't have to be, but it's better to kind of accept those truths and reanalyze your stance on a subject. I don't like to put myself in an echo chamber where I only surround myself with people who agree with me. I try to keep myself around a lot of different people who have different opinions and different views, and kind of debate and find out why they have those views, and kind of have that sort of empathy where I could be in their shoes and kind of say, oh, why they think that way. There's nothing wrong with the way that they think. This is their experience, and this is the way that they end up using their experience to form their views. And it was the same with Alien Covenant. I used my experience of the previous Alien movies to form my views and opinions on Alien Covenant. But what I really should have done is looked at it as a completely connected piece, but a different piece. And it was the fact that it had to be different from the rest, kind of comparing it to the way Alien Resurrection differed from Alien 3, why Alien 3 was such like a really sad, awful, painful movie. But at the same time, what Resurrection tried to do is kind of like lift it out of that sadness and kind of make it funny and kind of re-engage with the audience and make it fun. And I understood that. And Alien Covenant is kind of like the sad film of the prequel series, where Prometheus is so full of hope. It's a happy ending. It's kind of like the happy ending that Aliens had. But then Covenant is like, no, there's no happy endings in the Alien universe. This is reality, and this is what's happening. Someone who you idolized, who you thought was a prince and savior, who presented himself in Prometheus, David, is in actual fact the villain. And it kind of like turning that on its head, it surprised me. And the death of Shaw, just all of these things wrapped up, kind of like it subverted all of my expectations. And that's what I love about it. It wasn't afraid to deal out that pain, to say, this is not what you expected. Everyone expected Shaw to survive. Everyone expected her and David to team up and fight against the engineers, but that's not what happened. And that's what I love about it.
That's what surprises me about the people who have a negative reaction to it is it's Alien. What did you expect? Every single movie in this franchise has gone a totally different direction to the last one. There's not much thematic continuity in this franchise, and that it is a franchise about nihilism and how brutal and cold and uncaring the universe is. So to me, I loved that Alien Covenant went places that I wasn't expecting, that were painful, and I guess I'm masochistic because I keep coming back to it. I just, oh my god, this is so upsetting, give me more.
And the funny thing is that a lot of the ideas in Alien Covenant were unused ideas from previous scripts from as early as the original Alien, where Ridley Scott wanted to kill off Ripley, to Alien 3 and the use of the spores and the motes, which is something that came from O'Bannon's original script for Alien. So all of these things that people are complaining about that hate on the movie, all these aspects of the movie, they were there even before the Alien movie.
That's another thing I find funny is, I guess it's that fan ownership, which we can discuss later on, but that they assume that they know better than the creator. Like, Ridley Scott has been involved with this since pretty much day one. Speaking of creation, here's minute 53. All right. So we open with a point of view shot from David's perspective. It's just, he's walking down a corridor, and it's one of those little moments in a film that they're transition shots, which are very easy to overlook because by design, they're elements of the film that I like to say, they soothe the subconscious. They bridge one scene to the next, so they're not just cutting really harshly from one part of the story to the next. But these little quiet moments, to me, give you the truest sense of what it's like to be on that set or to be the character. And I really did feel like I was on the Prometheus for about 4 seconds.
I really enjoyed that part. It kind of reminds me of the panning shots that they had in the original Alien.
Yeah.
Even before you get to meet the crew and the crew wake up, you got the panning of the hallways, and you kind of have a feel for the ship and kind of let it surround you and envelop you. And I kind of feel like that is the case when you've got this scene kind of going around the corner and bringing you to the avenue of where everything is going to be happening. I really love that feeling.
Yeah, it's a shame that most movies, the background is just the background. You never get a good immersive look around a set. It's alive. It's definitely, it's not just a set. It is being occupied. It's a lived in space. My one criticism would be that, what is it in the original Alien? I think there's like a towel or a robe that's
like a
moving in the breeze. Yeah, something like that is moving in the breeze that shouldn't be there.
I
should have done a callback.
Oh, that would have been really cool. Yeah, that was definitely a missed opportunity.
And this particular, these 4 seconds here, it feels like the first Alien in terms of the handheld camera. That's what I love about the original Alien, is that you feel like you're there and you're a silent witness. And I think this scene, just because you've had that 4 seconds of the handheld camera, you suddenly feel like you're there too. This scene has always felt intimate to me. And I think I know why now, because of this.
Yeah, I also would like to point out that just in the background, you've got the little Christmas tree with the twinkling lights. And then you've also got the monitors hanging down from the ceiling, which are reminiscent of the Nostromo as well. So I really appreciate that sort of detail.
As you say, there are so many design elements that are still cohesive with Alien. I still feel this ship could be a part of the same universe. So we cut to a mid-shot of David, and as usual, his expression is unreadable. Holloway, meanwhile, is stooped over the pool table and doesn't even look at David until he asks, "Am I interrupting?" Charlie has clearly had quite a bit to drink already. We've been following him getting progressively drunk through the past few episodes.
He's drinking in every single scene.
Pretty much. And right here, he's occupying himself by playing with the little baby Jesus ornament that presumably came from the Christmas tree, which we should note has moved in this minute. Initially, it was on the pool table where Holloway is sitting, but I guess someone played a game, or maybe Holloway moved it because he decided that corner was his sulking corner.
He is pretty sulky, isn't he? Like, he's just brooding there. He's so disappointed.
And maybe it's because I've watched Upgrade, but at this time watching Prometheus and through this podcast, I've tried to be a little bit more generous and patient with Holloway, because as I've mentioned before, the film, it makes us side with David. You know, he's basically the first point of view character we get. But is Holloway really so bad? That is the question I'm trying to address in this podcast.
He's a bit of an asshole, but he's a nice asshole.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, what's the difference between Holloway and, say, Star-Lord or a character like that who, yeah, he's a bit of a jerk. He's not the perfect hero, but at least this far, he hasn't given us anything to outright make us hate him other than how he treats David, who is basically an inanimate object. I mean, he's animate, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the whole thing. Wayland retroactively speaking in his little speech to everybody in the crew pretty much said that David is a toaster.
Yeah.
So he has no soul, and therefore everyone is going to treat him like that.
Yeah.
They're not going to elevate him in any sort of way. And the only reason why Elizabeth Shaw did is because David saved her.
Mm.
So I feel like it's kind of like that Life of Pi, where the boy is in the boat and he kind of like has this relationship with the tiger, but then they talk about how when you look into something and you want to believe that there's a soul there, that there's something there that actually isn't, it's all just an illusion. And I feel like that's the same with David.
Shaw saw what she wanted to see. She impressed on him what she expected him to be. And David was just trying to be like Lawrence of Arabia, you know, gallant, helpful, and savior complex.
Yeah, I did talk about that in his rescue scene, that it really does feel like it's not concern that ever drives him, especially in a situation like that. It's the opportunity to be heroic. And Lawrence has a lot in common, or they both have a lot in common with each other in that respect, is just that idea of, I am destined for greatness and I must be greater than everyone else and do these heroic things and be selfless and endure the pain. And it is absolutely a savior complex.
Yeah, that's why he tried to step in and save people, you know, but at the end, just like Lawrence, David doesn't really get to be the savior, does he?
Well, even in the moments that he does, it is selfishly motivated, I feel. It's not, oh, I really care about Holloway and Shaw. No. I mean, I think his relationship, this is my theory, is that he's curious about Shaw at this point. I don't think he's emotionally invested. I don't even think he's really emotionally invested in Shaw until Covenant or somewhere in between these two films. Well, let's see. Towards the end of Prometheus, he's like, oops, poor choice of words. And, you know, just being the worst gynecologist on the face of the earth.
Yes, he's not got the best bedside manner.
No, not really. But getting back to the minute at hand, Holloway is deeply upset. And I think that's okay. He is emotionally immature. I will talk about this in a later minute, that he's sort of... Well, see, Shaw has her faith to ground her, to give her something, to help her contextualize what's going on, whereas I think Holloway is just really lost here, which I can definitely see that in the way Logan plays him. I'm actually noticing for the first time watching this minute, you know, that obviously... He's playing with the Jesus figurine. The symbolic intention is quite clear, but I don't think it's too heavy-handed. I really do feel like Charlie would have seen the little baby Jesus and then he just started ruminating on it all night, just going, who am I? What is humanity? Where do we fit into all this?
And he's just... what is faith? What is creation? What are we doing here?
Yeah, I think he's dealing with some... He's dealing with a lot of shit.
He's having an existential crisis. And he's placating himself with booze, which, you know, most people would if they were having an existential crisis.
Yes. So my other theory is that he's suffering from interplanetary jet lag. Can you imagine that? You wake up on another planet that doesn't even have a normal sun or solar cycle.
Yeah, there've been some scientific studies about how depressed and upset human beings get when they're not exposed to the sun. There's something about that, about sunlight, which helps us deal mentally with what we're presented with. And to not have our own sun, like how would that feel different there, being in a suit?
Yeah, I think we'd probably be okay on Mars, but on a space station, there are people who are already doing that and it does seem really tough.
Yeah, psychologically it's really full on for astronauts to be away from Earth, from the gravity and from the sun.
Yeah, and not to tangent too much, but having chronic fatigue for the past, 14 months? I think I'm over it for the second time. Here's hoping final time. But I really got into health and nutrition, and the biggest takeaway was that human beings have evolved to exist in a very narrow window of variables. So when I wasn't sleeping at the right time, like I was sleeping through the day, or I wasn't getting enough fresh air and sunshine, or I wasn't getting enough exercise, you start going mad. You are not made to live in a white room, basically.
Yeah, it would be testing for anybody. And I think for Holloway, going back to this whole scene with David, just not even Shaw has come to check on him. You know, even though he has been acting like a petulant child, being very pushy with her, it's kind of his way of saying, give me attention. And David is the only one who kind of cares. And even then, this whole situation, he doesn't actually care. Like you said, there's a different drive. He's working for Wayland. And otherwise, no one would have come to check on him or see him. He's just there moping, which I kind of feel sorry for him.
Yeah. And maybe David picked up on that because that's why he, well, I mean, obviously Holloway said some things to piss off David already, but I'm wondering if he ultimately just chose Holloway as a target because he knew he was isolated and in this particular moment, Holloway had pushed everyone away. Because, yeah, I mean, Fifield has been a bit of an ass to David as well, but I mean, I guess Fifield and Milburn never leave each other. I like to believe that they don't leave each other's side. They probably have bunk beds.
Yeah.
Matching pajamas. He's
probably showing him his rock collection.
No. It's, first of all, they have matching pajamas, but Fifield's cut the sleeves off, so he's got like a tank top thing going on. I imagine Fifield is like the. Have you seen the Disney movie Atlantis?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the mole guy who's obsessed with dirt and his bed is just filled with soil samples. Yeah, that's Fifield's bed, but with rocks.
Oh, right. Oh dear, that would be very uncomfortable.
No, he's got a little corner for his rock friends.
It kind of explains his sort of crabby attitude if he's not getting sleep, though.
Yeah, if he gets literally up off the wrong side of the bed. anyway, terrible jokes aside.
That's okay. I was just thinking the other day, and someone had presented me with this theory. I think it was either on my Utani Discord or on the LV426 Discord, where every day it's Alien Day. We were discussing the fact that just beforehand, David is kind of pushed against the wall with Vickers. And doesn't he have the goo on his finger at that point?
No, it's the scene just after. But why? There's no reason why he couldn't just go into Vickers' room.
And go after her. But he does say tea, mum. And I was just thinking, is he trying to, if they had moved to that scene then, could she have been the first to end up with the goo in her? But because she refused, it was Holloway.
Yeah.
I was just thinking that.
Because,
it's just a sequence of events. Mm.
And really, you could potentially edit those scenes in reverse order, and then you could make that implication even more overt.
I know that John Spates and Damon Lindelof did say that David didn't actually want to poison Holloway. He had to have his consent. So that's why I said, what would you do to get your answers?
Yeah, he's vulnerable on so many levels where Vickers would be a harder target, I think, because she's probably dealt with David for quite some time and knows his bullshit. And maybe, just maybe, Wayland says that Vickers is off limits, that you probably shouldn't experiment on her.
Well, he said, you know, try harder and do anything to get the results. I think Wayland is cold-hearted that he would just sacrifice her.
Now, I want to talk about colour in this minute. I can't really come up with any explanation other than aesthetics, but you've got a pool table that customarily it's green, here it's blue, and then both Holloway and David are wearing green and a very similar shade of green as well.
It's very earthy colours.
Yeah, it's the colours of planet Earth, so maybe that's the implication. The only other thing I can think of is maybe that in this moment, for once, David and Holloway kind of share similar opinions. They're both disappointed in their creators.
Yeah, there's definitely this, even though Holloway's treating him in a very condescending way, there's this camaraderie between the two. I think if David hadn't poisoned him, they could have had a good yarn and bitch about their creators and and what life is.
Honestly, I do feel like... And again, I am coming over to Team Holloway from doing this minute-by-minute podcast because there's a lot in this performance. There's a lot of thought in it. There's a lot of pathos, I guess. I'm starting to sympathize with Holloway. And just now I'm starting to think, yeah, if the two of them were stuck together in the way that Shaw ended up being stuck with David, I think a relationship, you know, a bit of a hostile one, but I think a kind of friendship could have emerged from that.
Yeah, I don't know how Holloway would treat David if Shaw would be the one to die instead. I think because he's just so needy,
yeah,
and so dependent, and I feel like Shaw is very independent of Holloway. You know, he's having his little cry in the corner, and Shaw's like, "Well, I'm just going to get down to business. You can go and cry all you want, but I've got a job to do." Whereas Holloway, I just don't know.
I really like that. The initial Spate script had Holloway like twice Shaw's age, and he had all the power and experience and all of that, where the power dynamic is much more balanced here, that they're closer in age, and Shaw is independent. She is level-headed. She is sensible and professional, where Holloway is more the wild spirit, which, you know, I think they complement each other well, and they need each other. And in this moment, well, I think maybe why it's not an even intentional failure, it's David's doing, but I think Holloway would have been much stronger had he stayed with Shaw this night.
Absolutely. But I like how he is not afraid to show his vulnerability even in front of an android.
That's another thing I like, is that he is an openly emotional character, that he... And not, well, I mean, on the surface you go, oh, yeah, it's that typical sort of toxic masculine dude bro sort of, but no, I don't think it is. I mean, there is that aggression, there is that sort of acting all tough when he's not, but he does have those moments of vulnerability which balances that out, I feel, that he does put on the tough front, but that's not who he really is.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And I kind of like the... It's really interesting. I'm just looking at the symmetry of the scene here. You've got the little champagne glass kind of half full, and it's reflecting the pool table. Then you've got like three bowls on the left, three bowls on the right. David's holding the upright champagne bottle, and Holloway is tapping the one that's upside down. There's just a lot of like this sort of opposition, two ends tugging at each other.
Oh, and then you also have the way that they're positioned in the scene is that David is standing above and he's very, very well lit, where Holloway is slouched down, he's as small as possible, and he's not lit that all that well, which I feel like is trying to highlight the fact that the android is man's creation. Look how perfect and superior he is.
Yeah, he kind of looks like an angel here, doesn't he? With the light shining on him.
There is something kind of angelic, yeah.
He's kind of come here to bring a message of goodwill, I guess, or bad will,
yeah.
to Holloway.
Well, in the Bible, you know, not every angelic visit was a good one.
That's right. And this is kind of mirroring the Annunciation, I guess, when the angel comes to tell Mary she will bear a child. And then there's Holloway holding the baby Jesus.
And then there's going to be a baby of sorts on the way. So I didn't even make that connection. This is why I have you on.
As well, I just want to bring up, just before I forget, with Lawrence of Arabia, there's this scene where he's in the army quarters and everyone's playing pool and he kind of grabs the ball and is trying to be cheeky and he tries to ruin the game by throwing the ball across the pool table.
Yeah.
And, you know, they call him a scoundrel. And then here's David at this pool table, having been sent on a mission just like Lawrence of Arabia. And he's about to kind of mess with Holloway, mess with the game that's being laid out in front of him. So I think there's a lot of symbolism in that too.
In all of Ridley Scott's films, there's a lot of very efficient storytelling. And that's why I come back to a lot of his works over and over again, even something like The Martian, which, you know, that was written by someone else and he didn't have as much influence over that aspect. But I noticed just visually, he is so good at cramming every frame with so much meaning. And even just talking to you now, I'm going, oh, right, yeah, of course, yeah. And then there's this and that and so many other things that I just didn't see, even though I watched this minute like 9 times.
That's what I love about the Alien movies in general. They kind of lend themselves to a multiple watch. You kind of
experience them differently every single time and you pick up new details. It never gets old, not to me.
I also like the fact that, okay, so David's hair is obviously blonde because of Lawrence, but going back to that sort of angelic imagery, and then we've mentioned Lucifer as well, like the hair color on, I haven't known another character whose hair color meant so much symbolically.
It's like he's walking around with a little halo.
Yeah. He's walking around with his own symbolism. It's like I have cosplayed as other characters that I haven't really bothered to change my hair color. Like Captain America, I go, it's sort of brownish blonde. Who cares? Like the hair colors are not important. So I don't bother. Like my hair's roughly the same cut. That's all that matters. But when it comes to David, I wouldn't even imagine putting on that costume without a wig or bleaching my hair, because it's just so much a part of him. And so when his hair tells his story so much in Covenant, when you see the long hair or when he crops it back and it's dark, it says so much about him.
With Prometheus, he's still in the glory of heaven, which is the Prometheus ship. He's still in the glory of God.
Right.
He's still a servant. But once he's fallen,
he's cast down.
And he's cast out, like literally, you know, abseiling down inside a bag with Elizabeth Shaw, and he ends up on Paradise. He's out of God's graces. He becomes more disfigured and ugly, just like Lucifer, and he's lost.
So Holloway says, pour yourself a glass, pal, when David offers a drink. I mean, clearly he's very aware that David's not a real boy, but again, he's just taken every bloody opportunity to rub that in. Just like, oh, sorry, I forgot, you're not human. Yeah, no. He can stop now. Anytime, Holloway. Actually, he could have stopped days ago. Maybe he could have gotten out of the situation.
Yeah, just say that whole thing, oh, you're not a real boy, kind of takes me back to the Pinocchio complex and what Pinocchio did do when he was a real boy, which was drink, smoke, gamble. There was definitely pool tables in where that island he ended up at.
There is some crossover with the Pleasure Island.
And on Pleasure Island, Pinocchio misbehaved and he changed and became a donkey. And I feel like that's kind of what happened.
He's an ass. When Holloway says, oh, you're not a real boy, David, smile wiped right off his face. Obviously, Holloway doesn't notice. And then this becomes another what I call a thesis scene. The first one was where David is enveloped by the hollow projection of the engineers. And he sort of, I feel like that speaks volumes about his character and also the intentions of the film. I find that so fascinating that, so you've got the creator, then you've got humans who are the creation. Then David's the creation of the creation meeting the original creator. Like that's a, wow. I can't even fathom that relationship.
Yeah, that's one hell of a family tree.
Yeah. But this scene and the exchange between David and Holloway, I think more so than that, summarizes the entire plot or conflict of this story. And Ridley himself has spoken about how he's fascinated by the idea of an android on a mission like this, that humanity is on a mission to seek its creators. Meanwhile, he's surrounded by his creators and not that big of a deal. They're not that great.
Yeah, they're all idiots.
It really is, just going back to that idea though, perspective. I think that's something, especially as a kid watching movies, I didn't really understand, but movies are so manipulative. And this film, thus far, I think now David's getting a little bit, you know, he's moving into a grey area here. But up until now, we've seen everything from his perspective. But giving Holloway a little bit more attention, you realise, okay, I mean, he's passionate, he's excitable, he's adventurous. He, in any other story, he's our main character. If anything, I've mentioned he kind of reminds me of Star-Lord. He kind of reminds me of Nathan Drake in Uncharted. It's just that in this particular story,
he's playing second fiddle.
It seems like he's playing second fiddle to Shaw, because we're made to believe that this is Shaw's film, that she's the replacement for Ripley.
If anything, he reminds me of Dallas in that sense, that in any other movie, Captain Dallas is your rugged, manly, super capable hero, a little bit like a... Well, yeah, Tom Skerritt's played other roles like that. They're kind of a Kurt Russell type leading man, but not an Alien. That's not the story they're telling. They're kind of coming at... They've sort of got a similar problem, but from different perspectives. So they're both disappointed in their creators. But David knows exactly who his creators are, and he also knows exactly what his purpose is. He hates the fact that he is purpose-built for menial tasks, basically, where Holloway is completely lost because human beings aren't made for a purpose.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether my husband would be happy about me discussing him on this podcast, but at one point he felt very saddened by the prospect that he didn't know what his purpose in life was. So he decided to go with what our base instinct is as an animal, is survival. And what speaks to survival is the procreation of the species to make sure that the next generation is able to survive without us, making sure that there's a roof over your head, food in your stomach, shelter. And that made him happier. It's the whole survival aspect. If you take all of that sort of stuff away, you're miserable. But people go, oh, duh, if you don't eat and you don't have a place to sleep, of course you'll be miserable. But it speaks so much more to us on a lizard brain level when it comes to achievements.
Yeah, definitely. So you'll be joining us for the next two episodes, yes?
Yes, absolutely. I can't wait to talk about the pyramid and the stupidity of running around in circles and the
Oh, yeah.
What is it? Looks like a Holocaust painting.
How many Holocaust paintings has he seen?
I have no idea, but I've had to look at a lot and they're very disturbing. The things we do for Alien.
The things we do for you listeners. So, this is Coulson signing off.
And this is Mother of Studio Yutani signing off.
You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TraviaN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.